And we are back at the Channel 9 stage here at TechEd North America in Houston. And I'm in awe right now, actually. I get to sit and talk with the Rusinovich, Mark Rusinovich. Thank you very much, first of all, for coming down. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having
me on the show. It's an honor that you're here. It's great. Absolutely awesome.
I love being on Channel 9.
It is. Yeah. It's fun, yeah, for the most part. You know, low stress. Sometimes it's stressful or not. But were you just coming off of a session you just finished up right now?
I did, about half an hour ago. Finished a session with Nathan Ide, who's a dev director in Windows Security. We gave a talk on Windows past the hash mitigations.
Oh, okay. Very cool. That will be available, obviously, on Channel 9 Live. Channel 9, msdn.com/event/TechEd in the not-too-distant future. I would like you to answer one thing for me, though. It's one of the questions that's been coming up an awful lot. How do you pronounce Azure? How do you pronounce that? The official Mark Rusinovich way when you're in meetings and talking to people.
Azure. You can think of it as Azure going to the store.
Okay.
You might as well pick up some cloud servers.
I like that. Yeah. That one's good. I like that one there. How about what's the coolest stuff you've been working on just recently that you're allowed to talk about, not the forward-looking stuff?
Coolest stuff I've been working on. The cool thing about my job is actually I work on a ton of cool stuff.
Okay.
And my job is focused on the compute aspect of Azure. So
right.
The compute platform, and that goes all the way from physical servers to data center architectures and rack architectures to the programming model, how VMs architecture to the programming model inside the VMs to the programming model across resource types. So some of the things that I've worked on recently is the resource groups that we announced at Build.
Okay.
And so that we kind of finished off the first phase of that. What I'm working on now is the next layer of like redefining the IaaS PaaS model, programming model. So you know we've got a PaaS in Azure,
right,
and we also have virtual machines.
Right, right.
And then we've been blurring them together. There's another big wave of blurring that's going to happen. It's been spending a lot of time on that. And then we're also designing our next generation data center architecture, which includes a combination of the server design for supporting virtual machines at higher density, plus disaggregated storage and local storage offerings,
right,
plus the data center, highly available data center architecture that, well, it's really a kind of a low availability data center architecture that allows for high availability given software architectures on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
So lots of fun stuff.
So you're actually in meetings where they're going through and looking at the architecture of how they're physically going to be putting in the now open standards compute model that will be done for being able to design our server racks and how they all work. You're down there to optimize where they sit and how they fit.
And actually, I don't get down to the electrical parts level, but it's more of the, I mean, there's a bunch of guys that work in that area that'll say, here's the racks in the U.S. data centers, or
put them in this order with this kind of stuff between them.
You can have a rack that's 48U, and if it's taller than that, you might have to tip it, and we don't want to do that. So then let's design a chassis that also fits European data. I mean, it's all sorts of stuff, constraints that go into it, and the amount of power that can go to a data center and the power per square foot that you can't, because of cooling, you need to have, but you can't drive too much power into a certain space.
Yeah.
So all of these constraints fit with the what hardware we're putting in the server and how much power do they draw, and that kind of mixes all together. It's just this incredibly complicated multi-dimensional constraint problem. And you can start with one little constraint over here, and that can have a ripple effect through the whole thing. And then you look at it and say, this isn't optimal, and where did this come from? And it's that constraint right there. Can we go address that? So
you go down all the way down that lower level, but then you're also working on the stuff all above it to make sure that's optimized to fit across all sorts. That's insane.
Yeah,
we go on that level of development and research as far as how we do our data centers worldwide for Azure and stuff like that.
And it's actually not just Azure, but all of Microsoft. We've got a unified data center strategy now across all properties. So kind of interesting the way Microsoft used to operate. You know, the old model of each group got to do its own thing, move at its own pace. And that came into play even with data centers where we'd be designing these data centers, and if a property was big enough, they'd say, I want a data center like this.
Okay.
And another one would say, I want servers that look like this. And over the past few years, as we've seen two of the big properties, Autopilot, which is this fabric that's underneath a lot of Bing, and Azure, which is powering a lot of the newer stuff, The two big properties dictating a lot of it, and now we've merged those two together, and now we've got a common, consistent data center strategy across the company. We still have some long tail things. You know, it takes a while to clean things up and get everybody on the right same.
So when we're onboarding new data centers, basically they have to be able to accommodate all the properties, not just this is going to be the Xbox Live one. This is going to be the office one.
Yeah,
now
It's and there's a lot of benefits to that because when we can focus on engineering efficiencies for just one type of infrastructure, so we're not diluting our, you know, those constraint optimizations across a whole bunch of different designs.
Yeah,
we get a common supply chain for all these parts, the racks and the chassis, and even data center build out becomes easier if you've got common design. And
do you talk with other fellows from other companies, like socially over pints or something like that, and talk about this kind of stuff too at that kind of high level?
Occasionally, it's tough to.
You know, there's here's the Azure guys, here's the Amazon guys, here's the Google guys getting together.
I think what we do, we read each other's papers and watch each other's presentations.
Oh, okay.
That's the way that we communicate.
It's a good way to do some kind of a limited knowledge sharing for how that goes. That also dispels the myth. Another one of the myths that had come up is that people were thinking that you created Azure on a bunch of G8 servers from HP or from Dell inside your basement in your house, and then it moved up from there.
That's because I used to show pictures and say, that's the one in my basement.
So that's not the case.
Yeah, that's not the case.
Good. We can put that one to rest. That's good. Another person to come up and ask me a question, because I was tweeting out saying I'm going to be interviewing Mark Vucinovic on Channel 9. I want to know what I can ask him. It's a little bit different. How about this one for you? What we do on one of our talk shows, we have a talk show called Patch and Switch, and we have this one thing that we call beer money. Mm-hmm. A beer money segment is basically the last time that you went ahead and just did random tech support for a family member or for a relation of some kind that came up to you at a barbecue or something like that. What was the last time you actually did something like that came up, and what was the topic?
Let's see. The last time was a friend of mine that couldn't get Office 365 to install.
Oh, yeah?
And I used Process Monitor and figured
broke out the tools.
Yeah, and found out that it was a proxy server issue that he had set up. And by seeing the access to, by actually seeing Office 365 trace and seeing that it had a log file, seeing that the log file showed that it wasn't able to access office.com download servers, and then said, wonder why that is.
It was a proxy misconfiguration on his part for his IT side of things?
Yeah, it was the... The proxy configuration in IE doesn't apply to Office.
Oh, okay.
It's this, because it's a long story, but the WinHTTP stack and proxies, but you've got to have an application that's proxy aware to take advantage of proxies. And I don't know if this is a limitation in the Office setup program or what, but managed to work around it.
I was about to say, I saw you over there at the Office garage. Maybe you're giving them some inside information on how to resolve that problem.
That's right.
Something like that. That's good. Channel9@msdn.com. There is the ability to go through and ask a couple of questions if you like up on the screen. Just go ahead, hit submit, and our friendly staff at the back will be able to approve those, and we'll be able to take a look at them. Talking here with Mark Vucinovic, obviously, no introduction required. How about some of the other new announcements that came out? I was actually met and I talked with a guy from Level 3 with ExpressRoute. Do you do work at all with the ExpressRoute guys with that kind of connectivity? How did that come about?
Yeah, actually, so I don't work directly on that area.
No problem.
That's a networking area, but I do work on it where it interacts with the application model. So for in applications, how you would model virtual networks, which relate to the ExpressRoute stuff. But the ExpressRoute stuff has been a long-standing ask from enterprises that, in many cases, from their own data centers, have MPLS links into colo facilities.
Right.
And so they wanted that same kind of going over private fiber into a data center so they're not traveling over the public internet.
Right. And obviously, because they're already getting that service, they're already familiar with that.
That's
and
right.
simply matter, hey, can you give us the little off-ramp that goes up to the Microsoft data center to be able to do that? And now they have it available. And then we announced at the keynote that it's now GA available now, too.
Now GA available. We've got a whole bunch of new providers signed up and more regions that it's going into. And it's just a snowball at this point.
Very nice.
Just signing them up and getting them in.
How many virtual machines do you have running in your demo account for subscription, instead of curiosity? I've seen them up on the screen, man.
Yeah.
You got a ton of them, instead of curiosity.
Well, I don't have them running unless I'm actually using them. So.
That's because they're billed by the minute, right?
That's right.
They're not costing anything.
Yeah, they're not costing anything. So it's just the storage, which is really, it's just pennies.
Right.
So the number of VMs, the VHDs that I have is probably in the order of 100 or so.
Oh, yeah.
But every time that I come and I do different demos or do different features, a lot of times I have to spin up new VMs and tear down the old ones.
Yep.
So it's that they're aging in and out over time.
Yeah. Very good. Very good. How about from the perspective of your sessions you're doing here this week? I know you've got at least four of them lined up that's going to be taking place. A couple of them are going to be broadcast and live streamed as well. Which one are you the most excited about doing?
That's a tough one, because one that's just a fun one, just raw fun, is the Case Unexplained, speaking of troubleshooting.
I love that one. Yeah. It's every single tech ed is coming through, and there's always new stuff you put in there.
And this one is just so much fun to look through these cases. Even just preparing for it is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I'm looking through all the cases that I've received over the last 6 months or whatever since the last one, and it's like, wow, this is really good. Oh, but this one's even cooler. This one has some cool aspect to it.
And where do they come in from? I'm curious. Like, where do you find them? Do you have like a mark@microsoft.com or something like that? you come in?
Well, I don't hide my email address. It's pretty public. And so people can just contact me that way. And a lot of people find it. People on Twitter, like actually literally today, somebody said, hey, I just solved a case using Process Monitor. And what I'll do is I'll tweet them and say, send it to me. So I collect it.
Cool.
So I get some that way.
And that brings up another thing is from the weird case of the last 6 months. Can you let us in on what you think is probably the coolest one that's new that you're going to be
case?
Doing? The coolest one that you came in with Case to Explain for some fresh content that's coming.
I mean, you know what's the cool thing about all of these is that you look at the failure and you say, how the hell could somebody figure out what's going on there? And there was one cool. So what I've been doing is picking fresh ones that are related to Windows 8.1 and Office 365. And this one guy had a case where he had he had Windows 8 with Media Server installed on it, and he was trying to do the upgrade to Windows 8.1, and the progress bar would get about 25%, and then it would just reset back to zero and start over, and it just sit there in that loop. He's like, what the hell? So he captured a Process Monitor trace, and it was one of those examples where Process Monitor didn't say exactly what the problem was, but it showed him that there was a log file, just like the other case I was talking about. Then he went and looked at the log file, found an error message in it that corresponded in time to when the reset happened.
Yeah.
And then that told him what the problem was.
Okay, so it's ancillary evidence that comes up during these things.
Yeah, it's just like you need one clue to point you in the right direction.
Because these other vendors, these other apps, they have no idea where they're storing their log files. It could be almost anywhere, and as long as they're able to write to them, they're able to find it. That definitely is a good source of troubleshooting. You bring up Process Monitor, obviously. It's one of your favorite tools over there. I'm a huge fan of Zoomit, just because I do a lot of presentations, stuff like that. I know you update them on a regular basis. How active are you in still doing stuff on the sysinternals side of the tool set that are there? How do you actively develop and code more stuff to it, or part of a team?
Yeah.
Open up the door a little bit and let us know what's going on there.
That's a really good question. I get this. I see people say, hey, thanks to the sysinternals team.
Yes.
And I'm the sysinternals team.
The team is right here, right now.
So
you've got the source code. You got a Git inside your office, little server.
I've got them in Source Depot, which is an internal source repository, but we're moving to Git now. I've got the repo set up, and it's just a matter of me getting back to the office and dumping everything into it and starting to go from there. But how much time I spend on it's really, it's kind of one of those fillers. It's like instead of playing solitaire, I'll go work on a sysinternals tool. Somebody asked for a cool feature, I thought of a cool feature, and I'll go spend a few hours on it. And there are some people that do big contributions. Andrew Richards, of course, big contributor to ProcDump.
Yeah.
And Ken Johnson, another guy at Microsoft, big contributor to Alive KD. Okay. So there's a few tools where there's like a handful of tools where there's somebody that will be contributing code into them.
And they're doing that all through Source Depot, all internally at this point in time.
That's right.
And then with your Git model, is it going to be open up for other people to look at as well? Or
the challenge is that a lot of these tools rely on undocumented functionality.
True.
That we don't want people to look at the code and say, I'm going to take a dependency on that same thing as well. So that's one of the limitations with making them public.
Very cool. We got Frank on the question line up here. How can the tools from sysinternals could be used to troubleshoot Azure communications problems? I know that you were one of the first tools just BG Info is now part of the Azure agent you can install on there.
Yeah.
I was cursing you the other day when I was using an Azure VM because I thought that you also had Zoomit in there as well. Apparently, Zoomit didn't make the
agent. You want Zoomit in there?
It would be great.
Yeah.
I don't know how valuable it would be to everybody else, but it would be great for us.
I'll see if I can get Zoomit in there as default, too.
But have you come across using the Azure, using your tools to troubleshoot on the Azure comms problem side of things?
So on the comms problem side, there's two tools that are related to networking that I've used before to troubleshoot Azure or to look at what's going on inside of Azure. One is TCP View, which shows it's like a netstat GUI netstat to look at what connections are going where from a machine.
Yeah.
And the other one is PS Ping, which is a relatively new tool that I wrote specifically for Azure to look at network performance in Azure.
Yeah.
There's an internal tool that's actually, there's a public version of it available called NTTCP. NTTCP.
It rolls off the tongue. It obviously eluded the branding mechanism within Microsoft.
Yeah, I think it's like NTTest TCP.
Okay.
Is the idea behind the name. But the command line usage is just as bad as the name of the tool. And so I'm like, I can't deal with this. And I need something more intuitive. So I wrote PS Ping.
Right.
And what it does is it does latency test, it does bandwidth test, it does UDP, TCP, it does TCP connection test, and it does ICMP as well. And it does sub-milliseconds, it'll do histograms, it'll you can specify time-driven tests, so a bunch of things that we in Azure use to look at network performance issues. And okay. I think the Azure CSS guys do too.
I don't know if you can answer this one here, but it's a big one. It's Vitaly. Normally, if questions are longer than 140 characters, it turns into like this big, massive thing. But we'll see what it is. Is MS working on further modularization of OS components, i.e. can one modularize the components of the operating system and custom-build machines instead of having an OS image that almost seems to have most of the typical things that you would expect in an OS image? This is like custom-build runtimes and base services.
Yeah.
Kind of a speech question.
So it's asking if Windows is heading towards being more modular and dynamically composable.
Yes, I think that's a good way to distill it down.
And the answer is we're looking at it. That's all I can say.
I like that approach to that answer. Yeah. I like that. Very good. Obviously, yes, the book is another thing I want to ask about because I know that you're going to be giving away advanced copies and signing them here at TechEd.
That's right.
Here, so talk about the next book's coming out.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the third book in the Jeff Akin series is Rogue Code.
Right.
So first one was Zero Day, was cyber terrorism. Second book, Trojan Horse, which is state-sponsored cyber espionage and cyber warfare. And the third book, Rogue Code, is about insider threats and financial cybercrime.
Oh, nice.
And if anybody's watched what's going on with Michael Lewis's new book, he's the guy that wrote Moneyball, for example. His latest book is called Flash Boys, and it's about high-frequency trading.
Yes.
And his claim, based on his researches and talking to lots of people, is that Wall Street, the trading system, is rigged by HFT algos and special trading codes that let them front run people with low latency. So I see that you're going to buy some stock over here. I'll go run over here where there's some on sale. I'll buy it and then sell it back to you and skim something off the top.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So the kind of coincidentally, I'd been looking at financial cybercrime and thought it would be cool to have a story about infiltration of like the trading engine, the New York Stock Exchange.
Okay.
And so when I came up with the idea of the book, I'm like, the bad guys could hide inside the trading engine skimming money, and it would actually look no different than high-frequency trading because the latencies are so small, the timestamps are from all over the place, so you can't really know when an order, did this order really arrive before that order? You really have to trust the log of the system, and so the bad guys could get in there and manipulate this. And so Flash Boys came out, and I'm like, wow, perfect timing. So Rogue Code has a heavy high-frequency trading element to it. In fact, I had a guy that is considered the whistleblower of high-frequency trading, Haim Bodick, write the foreword for Rogue Code.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that's the book. It's out on May 20th, but here at TechEd, I got the publisher to send advance copies.
Okay.
And we're giving away some at the office garage tomorrow, and then I'm doing signings at the bookstore tomorrow and Thursday.
Very cool. Have you now been blacklisted from being able to go off and visit NASDAQ after writing this book?
Well, probably New York Stock Exchange. I think NASDAQ probably would let
NASDAQ's
me,
okay, you know, but the Stock Exchange is not exactly happy with this kind of concept for beginning to do it. The case they explained, I have a case open Microsoft over 2 months and it's not solved yet. I have Windows 8 join the Active Directory, not able to develop any Windows 8 app. Which tool of system kernels can I use to start troubleshooting this issue?
Wow, that's a broad question.
That's a very broad one.
I have a case open for 2 months.
Yeah. It's not solved.
Not solved. Which tool can I use?
Yeah, well.
Well, that's not a lot to go on. I'd say start with Process Monitor. That's a safe bet.
That's the one that you seem to be defaulting to everyone to be able
well,
to
Well, that's actually...
Is that how you approach troubleshooting these days, starting off with that one?
It's not that I'm starting with that. It's that if you look at all the cases I've collected, literally hundreds of cases, 80% of them are solved with Process Monitor the initial clues with Process Monitor, which is surprising to me because I thought Process Explorer might be that number one tool, but it's Process Monitor. So we came up, Dave Solomon, my co-author on the Windows Internals book series a long time ago, he started to notice with me all of these random cases, like slow, sluggish performance, hangs, timeouts, error dialog boxes. you name the symptom, and Process Monitor would somehow reveal a clue to help you solve it. And so he came up with the slogan, when in doubt, run Process Monitor. So I sometimes have the audience in my talks do that.
I was always going with FileMon or RegMon and for stuff that I was doing for my troubleshooting and also trying to package my apps that I need to go off and deploy to find out all the different places it touched to be able to do stuff.
Yeah, and Process Monitor is a basically merge of FileMon and RegMon functionality.
Right. I'm old school.
Yeah. And Aaron Margosis, speaking of packaging, he's written PowerShell scripts that process monitor log files to give you basically a way to recreate an installation off it.
Oh, okay.
So it's app install recorder, he calls it.
Okay. Yeah. Very interesting. Did not know that. Yeah. Now, I know you obviously work on the compute side as far as Azure is concerned. Carlos has a question here. It's kind of interesting, and it brings this up, obviously, because we have different levels of stuff inside Azure. A VM with shared CPU is less expensive because you only pay for the app when the app is running. Could Azure offer VMs with more memory and shared CPU? I mean, on the shared side or the basic and then the standard, you have different levels of compute. The big ones, the big boys I know are coming down, the A8 and the A9s, they're coming down into the dedicated CPU side of things.
Yeah.
Had any customer requests that you're aware of or any kind of need to go
for a shared CPU and more memory? Generally,
it's not going to buy you too much more performance.
Yeah, on the high end, people generally want, when they're going to spend money, more consistent performance.
And right.
To get consistent performance, you want dedicated resources on the box. So it's really on the lower end that we'll start, that you can opt into having shared cores, or it's actually not fully shared. It's really, you're given a kind of a range of CPU performance between max of core or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some delta that depending on what other activity you might be fluctuating in. But the higher end VM offers, people are going to want it. If I'm spending money, I want my core that I'm getting, mm-hmm. and I want it there regardless of who else is on the box with me. So probably not with the high memory ones. And, you know, the memory is actually one of the biggest constraints on the box. I mean, we can split and share cores very easily, but RAM, you can't. There's no easy way to share RAM.
Otherwise, it starts to affect performance.
That's
right.
In a horrible way.
And it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So basically, you are limited by the hardware architecture underneath for the max amount of RAM on those different hosts for how big they get. Now, the A8s and A9s are coming out in the near future. We announced that they're coming down.
Yeah. Actually, they GA'd. I think we announced the GA, yeah.
I don't know if they were GA'd or if they just were announced they're coming down. Yeah. Either way, they're definitely bigger and they're definitely there. All I know is that my subscription cannot afford to run them for very long.
Yeah.
Nor would I have anything that actually needs to have that kind of horsepower to be able to do it.
It's like, I think the A9 is like $6 an hour, $5.50
an hour. $6 an hour. Yeah. It's still cheaper than having physical hardware, for sure. But I don't know if I want to do a quick little demo of just having those up there and then, oh, hang on a second, run the script to be able to go off and shut them down again. When it's there. How about throughout the stuff you've been doing with Azure over the last number of years, what's the kind of the most interesting thing that you've learned by switching to that kind of a mode, that kind of a model? I mean, a lot of IT pros out there are obviously faced with going from on-premises environment to a cloud environment. Yeah. You're working on the cloud. You're developing the cloud kind of stuff. What was kind of your cool thing or that aha, like, wow, that I can't believe this is now happening in the industry right now? What lit that up for you?
There's a whole bunch of things. It's tough to pick one. But I'll pick one that I had, kind of a realization I had relatively early after joining Azure. And this was this, if to go fast, you actually need to go fast. Which sounds kind of flippant, but one of the kind of pitfalls you get into when it comes to trying to take the traditional box product development approach into the cloud, is in the box product world, you have lots of people working on code, you integrate it, and then you test it, and it looks good, and then you push it out. And if there's a screw-up, well, you need to go back to fixing, integration, testing, and push it out. Yeah. And so it creates these long cycles, traditional box product cycles. The problem with the cloud is the longer you spend integrating and testing, the longer it takes to fix anything. And so the higher the risk of actually releasing something.
Okay.
So that creates this pressure to test longer, which means that it's going to take you longer to fix anything, which
is not good when things are down.
It's not good when you roll something out and there's a problem, because then you're stuck with this slow pipe to get stuff out to fix it. So really what you want to do is be continuously releasing little things. You don't spend a lot of time integrating. You have isolated tests. So if something goes wrong in the test, you know pretty much it's one of these few things that has screwed it up, not this, oh, crap, we're integrating from 20 different giant features, which one is it that screwed that up?
Right.
And then you've got an engineering system that pushes it out very quickly so that if something does slip through your testing, then you can turn around, fix it, and push out real quick to fix it. So this is it's kind of just go fast to go fast. Like push your engineering systems to go fast, mm-hmm. and that'll help you go faster.
And how, again, working with the engineering team sort of stuff, how have you seen us adapt to that? Has it been?
It's been painful. It's yeah? actually, yeah, it's actually all of this transition from box product to cloud, this is what I look at companies out there, and there's some big companies, big players that are cloudifying everything and cloud washing
yeah.
their marketing.
All the marketing.
And you look at the way that they develop software, and it's box product, the way they develop it. And then I look at what we've done at Microsoft, starting this journey in Azure. It started in 2006, and other parts of the company even longer ago that are even more better, further along than Azure mm-hmm. at this. And you say, those guys, if they're just getting started now, there's no way. I mean, they're so behind the curve on this. It's yep. going to take them so long, because it's not something you just flip and say, let's do dev. You know, people call this DevOps. Let's switch to DevOps and boom, go. Because you need culture, you need tools, you need engineering systems, you need the whole pipe and a whole shift of mentality to get mm-hmm. to it that you can't just get overnight. It takes years to develop that muscle.
And looking internally, we've got it. We're there. We're going.
We're got it.
We're
well,
fast,
there's always
man.
Room
like,
for improvement.
I mean,
yeah.
it's definitely improvement. I remember yeah. with Scott Gu on stage at Build, just like, I've got 44 plus announcements that are coming out. And it's like, boom, just yeah. next. It's insane. And
yeah.
then, you know, even something as simple as, for me, like I was going off and doing some demonstrations with PowerShell and Azure. And it's like, oh, damn, the PowerShell's just revved again on May yeah. 7th. Like, I go off and get them again. It's constantly always updating everything else, which is always a challenge. How about you've led a very varied life. You've got this celebrity status inside, inside and outside.
Here at this table, I guess.
Inside and outside of Microsoft. Who's the coolest person you've met from a celebrity perspective over your travels over the last number of years,
coolest
man?
Person
you're an
I've
author,
met.
You're a SysInternals tools, you're an yeah. absolute guru when it comes to IT stuff.
Okay, well, I mean, the
coolest person
I guess this
met.
One's hands down, Neil Armstrong.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I met, so this is a Star Trek convention. I managed to drag my wife to. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah?
This was
she's not a Trekkie fan?
Well, she
is. Tolerates it?
Yeah. Now she is. Actually, I've made her watch all of Star Trek Next Generation.
Yes.
And what was the one after that? Well, I'm having a brain fart. You're talking about brain farts.
She came to the convention.
Yeah, she came to the convention. It was the Beam Me Up Scotty convention.
Oh, yeah?
And I think it was in 2004 or 5.
Yeah?
It was... James Doohan, who's played Scotty's last convention, he had Alzheimer's and Parkinson's.
Oh,
and
man.
So they knew that this was going to be his last public appearance.
Mm-hmm.
So they had this convention, and it, you know, the whole original cast came to it. It was in L.A.
Yeah.
So we flew to L.A. and went there, and, you know, I'm like, who knows if I'm going to get my wife to go to Star Trek convention again. So we're getting, like, you know, premier black gold status, you know, first in line to get pictures, table right in the center of the room in front of the thing. And so we sit down at the table, and I'm looking around to see who's around me, and I turn my back, and the tables are pretty close to each other, and Uhura is sitting right here.
Oh, yeah?
Chekhov is sitting next to her, and then literally back to back with me is Neil Armstrong.
Wow.
And I was so yeah, so I of course had to lean over. Hey, Neil, good job at the moon.
You really were there, right?
Yeah.
I heard he actually cold clocked someone at some
yeah.
point when they asked him that. It's like, what are
yeah.
you, crazy? Of course we were there.
Yeah.
Absolutely, of course we were there. This is actually a good question from Vitaly as well, and it's come up an awful lot in all the conversations I've had in the last little while. What is a simple and repeated thing that you could do to learn and explore and repeat, learn, explore, the Cloud OS, Windows Azure, and other stuff like that?
Yeah.
What would you suggest?
Just play with samples. Just, you got to play with it. I mean, that's the first thing I did when I came to Azure was... Get the SDKs,
mm-hmm.
start to deploy, and I mean the only way you're going to learn is actually by getting your hands dirty.
Yeah, I mean for my session that I did with Joey just yesterday, it's like we need to go and integrate this into it, and we're just bashing away at being able to get the
yeah.
demos to work and just manage to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah, and it's painful, but you learn a lot actually as you fail that's, along the way, right?
That's the best way to
yeah.
learn,
yeah.
right? You face with a challenge, go off and try to solve it, and then off we go. Larry's asking, when does the movie come out?
I wish I knew. You know,
you've got signing rights to the movie.
Yeah, I sold the options. I got some money in the bank for it. Anyway.
Oh, nice.
And
they say don't do anything until you get the contract.
Yeah.
And the money's the bow on top of the package. So
yeah.
it's definitely gonna something's gonna happen. So
well,
cool.
the contract's signed, the money's in the bank, but the way things work in any, you know, of this area, publishing or movies.
Yeah.
It's all just random. I mean,
yeah.
So we'll see. There's a, always on these things, there's a time, there's a clock, right? They've got to do something with a certain amount of time, or if they want to renew, they got to pay more money. So we'll see. The clock is ticking.
Well, the important thing that someone's also asked me as well is if the main character, Mr. Aiken, is going to be wearing a Tilly hat
yeah.
or not.
Yeah, and so where did that come from, actually?
So last year,
yeah.
Someone actually came and took the hat off my head and took a picture of the hat.
Yeah.
And the next thing I know, at TechEd, this Twitter account was created. And just so you know, I do not tweet Rick's Tilly hat. Someone else does. And somehow they get pictures of the hat in different situations.
Yeah.
And it just comes out. So apparently he's a big fan.
Yeah.
And I think it'd be a good compliment
we'll
to the character development.
If
somehow,
if there's a movie, I'll see if I can figure.
Put that into the rider.
Hat in. Yeah.
See if we can put that one into the rider.
Yeah.
We got a couple minutes left before you go off to Slate and off to the next session. This one here makes sense to you over here, as far as Ravi is asking a question. Is there a particular reason why web jobs are nested under an Azure website from the compute perspective?
It is actually web jobs are built on the same infrastructure as websites.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're going to see if you look at the new UX, the new portal.
Right.
They're not. Each resource is in its own.
They're split off.
Yeah. Split off.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of, again, transitioning between the different portals for how they're going to be all off and working. Like, I know a lot of, obviously, the infrastructure stuff doesn't show up on the new portal as of yet. Eventually, it'll get there and people do stuff. And that's that, too. This countdown clock keeps on changing. Like, I'm trying to wind things up and, you know, give this man his time to go off and do his thing, and then more time keeps on coming up, which is awesome. For awesome sort of stuff. Favorite Star Trek character?
Favorite Star Trek character? That would be Patrick Stewart.
Yeah.
Yeah?
He did the best job. So
he
obviously, if I'm going to ask you, which of the favorite captains, it's obviously going to be Mr. Stewart.
Yeah, that's it.
Captain Stewart.
Yeah. I mean, it's a close one, but yeah.
He makes the most sense, I think.
He does.
It makes the most sense. You know what? I think we're going to actually let you trail off and go off in the sunset. You've got a lot of activities still going on for tonight and also for tomorrow. And thank you very much for taking the time
Rick.
To stop by.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's
and,
always fun.
We will be back at the Taste of TechEd for the final session of the day. Mark Rusinovich in the house. And we are out to Slate, my friends.